to our Diversity on Boards podcast. I'm once again joined by Teresa Johnson, corporate partner at law firm Arnold & Porter. And since we've last spoke, I have to mention that Teresa has been recognised as one of the top 25 corporate transaction attorneys in the publications, the Chambers USA California 2021 publication for annual list of top 100 women lawyers. So congratulations, Teresa.
You're
very welcome. You obviously have a particular interest in diversity on boards as an advisor to board directors and your corporate governance work. This podcast today, I wanted to focus on how are we actually going to, if we can talk about how we're actually going to change and challenge board diversity, how is that going to be achieved? And I know there's quite a lot of change that's been happening in your neck of the woods, and wondered if we could talk about that first. Why do you want to just explain the challenges that have come about to the California mandatory board diversity legislation rules in recent months, and whether it's been surprising that the challenges, how that's played out?
Of course, and hello again, and it's great to be back together talking about this really important topic, and much has happened since we last spoke on this. So to recap quickly, in California, we have laws on the books that require a minimum number of women on corporate boards, meaning specifically the boards of publicly traded corporations that are headquartered in California. And there is then a companion law that requires that there be a minimum number of directors from underrepresented communities, similarly on those California headquartered publicly traded companies. Since we spoke last, there has been progress in the litigation that was brought by conservative groups challenging those California laws. And in this year, in fact, the California Superior Court, meaning the sort of the lower court, the lower state court, heard the challenges for both of the gender and the underrepresented communities laws, and in both cases struck down those laws. So the conservative activists have been successful in their initial challenge. Those cases are going to be appealed by the state, by the Secretary of State through the Attorney General. So it's not the end of the story. It's just, you know, the beginning of the first step. But I think it was notable that the legislation was struck down in both instances. It wasn't entirely unexpected, as there were questions about whether those laws were going to be enforceable when they were first adopted, quite a bit of discussion around that. So the filing of litigation wasn't a surprise. To some degree, even the fact that those laws were struck down wasn't a total surprise. But interestingly, I think I'd frame it all in the context of the politics of today, and that a lot of this comes out of a sense of division between the liberals and the conservatives, and there's a broader pushback against what some people would refer to in quotation marks woke capitalism. And that's playing out in other arenas as well. So we'll see how the litigation progresses on the California cases. And there also is similarly a litigation around the NASDAQ rule that focuses on board diversity too.
It's great to hear that there is an appeal in process. Great in any way from a legal perspective. I'm interested to get your view on whether you think the diversity on boards that has been achieved in California is going to go backwards. Is it going to look retrospectively and go to the pre-2018 composition, do you think? Or do you think that the changes that have been achieved as a result of this legislation since 2018 is here to stay?
It's a great question. And I think that's one of the things that I feel optimistic about. There has been enormous change in the makeup of California boards subject to the laws since they went into effect. And this is in the context of an environment where it was expected that these laws would be legally challenged, and there were questions around whether they would ultimately be upheld. And so you could see in a different situation that companies may have decided to hang back and, you know, maybe not jump into complying, waiting to see whether the laws were going to be upheld. And that is not what happened. Companies got on board and diversified their boards. There's been an enormous uptick in the number of women, and to a lesser degree, but still impressive, the number of members of underrepresented communities on the companies that are subject to the California laws. And I think the real push for that is because the impetus for diversifying boards is coming not only from the laws, but also and significantly from the investor community, from the institutional investors who control a huge amount of publicly traded shares. And I'm referring to like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, you know, the large institutions that control, you know, vast arrays of the stock that's voted. And then also from other big players in the investment community, like the investment banks are pushing on this and making it a criteria of taking companies public that they have a sufficient amount of diversity on boards. Pension funds in certain states are pushing hard. For example, in California, the California pension funds are pushing hard on that. So I do think that the boards will continue to be diverse going forward, following the California legislation and the NASDAQ rule. And I think that will continue regardless, frankly, of what happens in the litigation. I will say, as sort of the caveat to that, that there is a pushback against board diversity in the broader context of a general pushback against ESG. And we're seeing in some instances where that pushback is being realized by pension funds. For example, in Florida and Texas, the state pension funds have announced that they will limit their investments in either companies or investment managers that do not support fossil fuels or that are focused on concerns other than just pure pecuniary return. In other words, that they won't invest the state's pension funds in investments that are focused on something other than just bringing money back. So there is that pushback, and I think in the end boards will remain diverse, but it's worth being aware of that kind of competing force, because I think we're going to see that coming back as kind of the whiplash effect of the enormous amount of support and attention that's being paid to ESG concerns in a variety of quarters.
Well, that's interesting. I actually hadn't heard that before. Is it something that is to do with the current economic climate? In my mind, that's as much as something rather than, I don't know. Anyway, that is really interesting. But in all respects, to have a challenge against a push in one direction does achieve some balance, and you can't just carry on regardless. That said, in relation to the legislation objective achieved, you have greater diversity on boards, and it does sound by and large it's here to stay. Apart from the investment community in that respect trying to drive change in a different direction, are there any other things that you hear in the community on boards that is giving them concern for a dilution of the diversity on boards?
I think that the main concern will really be around, as you've noted, economics. And I think to the extent that we continue to see high degrees of inflation and there's increasing pressure on the economic results of companies, I think it may become more difficult for companies to be more focused on ESG concerns if they feel like they're, you know, that it's adversely affecting their returns. The connection to board diversity there is more attenuated, because while there are indications that having a more diverse board, there are some studies that show a correlation between a diverse board and better performance, and some debates around whether there's a causal connection there. It's more attenuated to have a diverse board than, say, to be, you know, investing in green bonds or applying ESG concerns to your supply chain and potentially then making decisions around using suppliers who may cost more but have a better record on human rights, for example, or those kinds of things. And so I think where we're likely to see more somewhat of a backsliding on ESG is going to be more in those spaces where there's more of a direct connection between the two. But I think one of the things that's really going to be interesting about all of this is that there's a lot of interesting legal issues in terms of the way that these challenges are being framed. In the NASDAQ case, which was just argued in the Fifth Circuit, the SEC and NASDAQ, who were defending the case, and the litigation was brought by essentially the same organization led by Edward Blum, who's a conservative activist who challenged affirmative action for Harvard, and is now on its way to the Supreme Court. His challenge to the NASDAQ law, which was heard in the Fifth Circuit a few weeks ago, was focused on equal protection and First Amendment challenges. And one of the interesting legal issues there is that the SEC and NASDAQ, in defending against the challenge, noted that the NASDAQ rule, unlike the California rules, is not a mandate. It's a basically, diversify or explain. And so part of their focus in defending against it was to say that the reason that they framed it that way was because investors are interested in knowing about how diverse a board is. And so they want to make sure that public companies are providing that information to their investors. And that's it's a different focus from the California rules, which are more focused on the state has an interest in having a diverse board. And so the arguments that the SEC and NASDAQ were making in those cases are not going to necessarily add support to the California cases because they're focusing on something where there's a distinction between the two. So in terms of how this is all going to play out legally, it's a little hard to foresee, but I think the business forces are going to continue to push towards greater diversity on boards, full stop.
Yeah. Obviously the NASDAQ method of increase in diversity through the basically transparency as to the composition of your board's diversity is mirrored in respect of some of the FCA mandatory obligations in the UK, where certain listed companies have to either comply with it is a voluntary target of women and other diverse board members, or explain why not. So it very much follows the NASDAQ ethos there, and very much follows the way in which the UK has been implementing its diversity legislation through trying to get compliance through peer pressure rather than, I guess by peer pressure, it's not just other public companies, it's pressure from the investment community, which is considerable actually. And I think that's really moved on the diversity on boards in the UK. Even though this obligation has only been applied to the FCA, as I said, certain listed companies, it is something now that's being followed through in the UK by the FTSE Women Leaders Review, which was first published in February 22 and has taken over from the Hampton Alexander Review, which lasted through to 2021, I believe was the last one. It was supposed to be 2020, but I think the pandemic pushed it back, where they are just measuring where companies measure up against the new target of moving on from the Hampton Alexander Review, was pushing a 33% target of women on boards. The target now from the FTSE Women Leaders Review is 40% target of women on boards. And so they are measuring how boards are doing in respect to that. And in the top FTSE 100, there's 48 companies which are meeting it, which is quite impressive, to be honest. Oh. But they've also, and they've also introduced some additional targets in respect of other diversities as well.
Has there been any pushback in the UK similar to what we've seen in the US, where there are conservative forces, you know, trying to challenge the idea that boards should be diverse, and pushing back on the notion that a diverse board helps achieve better financial results and you know, better performance generally?
Well, I would say generally there is an undercurrent of pushback on the basis that by increasing diversity in any respect, you are creating positive discrimination against white men. And that mm-hmm. there has been an undercurrent of that, not just on boards, but generally over the last 10 years, in particular, male-dominated sectors, which although boards are not a sector, they have been dominated. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial here. They have been dominated by white men, which is why the whole Hampton Alexander Review, the FTSE Women Leaders Review, has taken place to increase that diversity and opportunity. So the pushback that has been seen is concern about positive discrimination against white men, and not so much, not necessarily just in relation to boards. We've seen that happen where certain sectors have brought in diversity targets, so similar to the diversity targets that are being brought in relation to boards, and where organisations are entitled to undertake what's called, so in the UK we call it positive action, where you take, you can adopt a variety of measures to try and increase the composition of candidates who are available to you to appoint to your board or to appoint to your senior leadership team, because obviously these diversity targets, they're not mandatory, but they are set at the board appointments, but also at your just below board appointments, your executive leadership team, so that you create that pipeline. And so it's that tension at the moment in the UK, which is really interesting. And there was a recent—
That's interesting.
Yeah, there was a recent discussion in the press about a public organisation, well, the RAF, having allegedly a policy of positively discriminating against white men to increase the diversity of their candidate pool and actually push certain candidates above the white men that were sitting in the pipeline in order to meet some pretty stringent diversity targets that had been set by the Home Office imposed on the RAF.
And so essentially that to me sounds like affirmative action is the way we have looked at it, where it often comes up in the context for us of college admissions, and that's the subject of the Harvard case that's being brought by Edward Blum. But there's it's the same sort of thing where there's kind of a thumb on the scale for candidates who are diverse and trying to kind of design to try to remedy a history of past discrimination as evidenced by the fact that there's been such a paucity of diverse people on, you know, in colleges or on boards or in senior leadership over time. So I see a parallel there in terms of the issues being raised. Now RAF, just to make sure I'm clear, that's the Royal Air Force, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Got it. So essentially, this is coming up in the context of the military, and that's it's interesting that it's coming up there. I'm not sure that I've seen the same kinds of issues coming up in the military here. But has the RAF whistleblower, you know, publicity then kind of had a ripple effect and had others saying, oh, you know, this happened here. Has it kind of, you know, it created a groundswell of more whistleblowers popping their hands up and saying, you know, we're saying the same thing in different organizations?
Well, I would say not yet, but I do see it opening the floodgates really for other whistleblowers to feel some confidence in coming forward if they think that there has been some positive discrimination occurring. As I said, it's only allegations that are being made by this whistleblower. And what it does do for me is it outlines the difficulties that boards will face in trying to meet these diversity targets, even though they're not mandatory, in trying to do its recruitment. So where we've spoken with certain executive recruiters, they will often say, we have to change the terminology of people instructing us to provide candidates for the next board position so that they are providing a balanced candidate group and not meeting an objective of appointing a woman or appointing a Black candidate. It's trying to make sure that board recruitment stays the right line of positive action rather than moving into positive discrimination. So it is really interesting though to see discussion coming into the public domain, whereas I'd said before, it's been rumours. They've only been articulated as rumours until now. Mm.
Well, it's interesting too, because some of the things that you're talking about with respect to how the candidate pools are put together, and then, you know, who ultimately gets the brass ring. In the California litigation about the board diversity laws, one of the interesting things that came up, which was somewhat of a surprise in the way that the decision was framed, is that the judge, in knocking down the diversity law, took the position that the way that the legislature looked at the law and looked at the reason for making the law was to kind of compare the composition of corporate boards to the population at large, like, you know, the looking at it kind of in a societal level. And the way the court looked at it was to say, well, really what you should have been doing was comparing the sitting board members to the pool of candidates who were considered for the board, and whether essentially there was suggested evidence of discrimination, that of, you know, 10 candidates, the white man was always getting selected or something like that. And a challenge about that is that the nature of the board selection process is one that is rather opaque, and it's not like there's necessarily kind of a pool of X candidates that you can point to say, like, these people were all considered and we chose this one. You know, the process is often very much driven by relationships and informal connections, and so there's not necessarily a kind of, you know, like, it's not like a job where people apply for it and you could look at the applicant pool. Mm-hmm. And the court mentioned, I think, something about that there maybe could be perhaps some benign reason that the pool of candidates tends to skew more towards a, you know, a less diverse group, and so to the extent that occurs, then there's really not the same reason to look at the, you know, to be concerned about discrimination. And I think, you know, there it suggests a rather narrow view of the way this process works and the concerns being raised in terms of diversity, because the nature of the board selection process is one that is typically very much driven by networking and relationships and so forth, and historically, women and members of underrepresented communities have not had the same access to those informal networks that white men have had. And so it's changed, you know, that means that those women and members of underrepresented communities often just don't even get into the room. They don't get into the pool of people who are maybe being thought about. So it can be a complicated issue in trying to sort of think that through.
It's great to have had that discussion, that being analysed, the candidate pool and how you get into the candidate pool, to have been analysed at such a high level. And that's exactly the issues that all of the groups are trying to, the pressure groups and the investors are trying to change through the through this activity. Teresa, right. I think we've got much more to say on this, and we will do in our next podcast. But indeed, for the moment, I'm just going to say thank you so much for explaining what's been happening in California with the legislation. And do we have any, I guess it's too early to say when this might go to appeal or when that could be heard.
It's in process. It's going to take a while. The state has announced that it's planning to appeal. The procedure is such that it's a rather lengthy process to, in terms of I'm not even sure that we know at this point what the timing is for requiring the filing of appeals. And this will play out over a course of years probably. But what's also interesting too, just to come back quickly on the NASDAQ case, is that the panel in the NASDAQ case was, listening to the oral argument, did not seem very sympathetic to the plaintiffs, the conservatives' concerns, which is notable. Interestingly, the three judge panel, which is sort of determined from among the pool of judges in that circuit, happened to be comprised of entirely judges who were appointed by Democratic presidents, which is, I think, relatively unusual for that circuit. The majority of judges in that circuit were appointed by Republicans. So there's a little bit of statistical statistically unlikely that there would be such a panel. So where I'm going with this is that if that panel decides to uphold the NASDAQ law, then there will be rights to appeal. There could be an appeal en banc, which means to the entire circuit. There then could be an appeal to the Supreme Court, and so I think it's worth keeping in mind that the Fifth Circuit decision in this case, isn't necessarily going to be the end of the story, and you kind of have to look at the next pool of potential decision makers to see how that's likely to be determined. So more to come, and again that will play out over time. So that'll be an issue we'll continue to watch as time goes on.
Absolutely, and keep the discussion going.
Here, here.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to discuss this again.